Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to Hopelessly Romantic Behind the Page. I hope we've had a lovely week. I really do. Now that the sun has decided to make more regular appearances out here in my neck of the woods, I am certainly feeling a lot better about spring, that's for sure. Just went out for a really nice walk, and it was a really, really nice day today. But we all know why we are here. We are going to take one last look at last week's read, Fit by Rebecca Weatherspoon. So I would probably agree that my general feelings about Fit were pretty much all over the place. I thought I would be getting more, if that makes any sense, like more of it when I bought the book. I'm wondering if I would have purchased it if I had actually seen it in the bookstore up front, you know, given that I was surprised at how short it was. Like, I don't know if I would have really given it a second look if I saw how skinny it was among the other books. Short erotic romance novels are pretty common, but I see a lot of those more in the realm of the ebook world. I get the feeling that, you know, it's like there's maybe a few thousand word novellas and they get put into the ebook commerce sites, I guess you could say. Granted, I do feel that the audience who reads erotic romance might lean towards ebooks in general, but as we all know, I am after those physical copies. I am kind of surprised to see Fit in physical print, if I'm being honest. It really does feel like something that a loyal reader of Weatherspoon would happily pay a couple of dollars for, just to get it into their e-reader of choice. It's not too long, it focuses more on the sex and the relationship, and it's something that you could probably really easily read during your downtime when said downtime might be limited. Now, do I regret buying Fit? I would say no, not really. It was a change of pace from our usual fare, but if I'm being honest, I certainly prefer my novels with a bit more of the story attached to it. When I really think about it, that's probably my biggest complaint with Fit itself. I wanted more of it, if that makes any kind of sense. I wanted more of the fitness. I wanted more of the BDSM. I wanted more of the relationship. As it was, I felt that the story was just a little too small to deliver on any of these points. I wouldn't change my spice rating from a 3 to a 2, not after the fact, but sitting here with some separation from the novel, I don't really remember much of the sex at all. It just wasn't memorable, I guess. Like I mentioned in my review, I didn't feel like the BDSM aspect went far enough to really grab my attention. I feel as though Haven did a better job with BDSM as a concept. Like, it gave us more of an inside view than Fit did. Our characters just, you know, they explored more of the BDSM concept. And really, when I picked up Fit with its promise of BDSM and fitness combined, I was really hoping that I would maybe get some clever predicament scenes involving creative use of exercise equipment. I wanted that boundary to get a little pushed. I won't say that orgasm denial wasn't fun to read about, but it's a standard tool in any dom's bag of tricks. It would have been great to see Grant take the domination side and mix it up with the physical trainer side. And I've just been really thinking a lot about how much more the novel could have been. If I were to spitball some ideas on a potential workshop for Fit, like, you know, if we wanted to workshop it a little bit, I think I would have felt better if Violet already had a foot in the BDSM door. So let's say maybe she was already regular at a local BDSM club. Maybe she could have had connections through the club that maybe led her to Grant as her personal trainer. And because he already knew that, he was already on the up and up, he could possibly suggest the domination slash submission style of training as an option for them. And Violet could have a, you know, why not moment. Maybe they could explore their relationship as they discovered that they maybe have some attraction for each other. I kind of want to see maybe one of these stories where one of them isn't already in the know. I think that would have been a fun way to approach the mixture of BDSM meets fitness erotic romance. Again, I think Fit as it is could work better if it had more time to explore its themes. I just prefer more romance with my erotica. And there's also Violet herself. And again, really, this would have been solved with more time and space. Grant was pretty solid. Like, he knew where he was, he knew what he wanted, and he was pretty okay with getting to where he thinks he needs to be. Violet is a little all over the place. She has a goal in mind, to lose weight. That was where she started, and then she ended up more focused on a sexual relationship with her trainer. And then at the very end of the novel, we learn that she's more focused on general health. If I'm being really honest, the subject is hard for me. I deal with this every day. I try to work for general wellness. I try to get to that goal. And it's exceedingly frustrating when those choices don't do much for the scale or my waistline. But general wellness is a good mentality. I just don't see or feel that we could watch Violet get to that point. We get tangled up in this sudden romance drama that we can't see Violet's mindset transform. Like, the idea of, you know, waking up at like 6 a.m. to go walking is really hard. And all the way up until like nearly the end of the book, her only focus is trying to lose weight, and then she gets focused on Grant. And I don't really see that exploration of working through her health. And I mean, she signs herself up for a difficult and demanding class in order to help herself get Grant back, and then she passes out as a result. That's not healthy. I liked Grant's approach. He went with small changes, small steps, find out what you enjoy. For some people, walks and runs are the height of boredom. For others, it's what they live for. And exercise doesn't just have to be walking into a gym. It could mean finding a meaningful activity that kind of inspires you. I don't just lift weights. I ride horses and I participate in dance classes. Am I any good? Debatable. But do I have fun? Yeah, that's the point, because at the end of the day, that's what matters. Life is too goddamn short for us to suffer on a treadmill if we hate it. Find out what you like. Go after it. Same thing with the books we read. I don't have that tagline for nothing. It doesn't matter what it is, just so long as we enjoy it. And, well, speaking of things that we like to read, I'm gonna let you all get your pitchforks out for this, because for what Heather's been reading this week, I'm still on a Twilight binge. That's probably a good proof as how much I don't really necessarily want to talk on the themes of fit, because I just want to talk about this right now. Before y'all rightfully tie me to the pyre that I deserve to burn on, I will ask for a chance to explain myself. And I'm also going to say that I'm about to go on a rant where I dump a bunch of Twilight opinions that nobody's asked for. So if y'all want to peace out, I understand. I'll see you later. But if you're still here, enjoy the ride, I guess. I'll offer that I haven't just read Twilight for this week. I've actually been reading Life and Death, Twilight Reimagined, and Midnight Sun. So we can start to look at the problems that folks have with the original Twilight, and how these problems are either addressed or altered with the addition of Midnight Sun and Life and Death to the canon. So if you already can't figure it out, I love Twilight. Unironically, I love it. I mentioned some of this on the last Behind the Page edition, and I'll just kind of rehash some of those points. I like it because it's hilarious and easy to read. Basically, it's literary junk food. Like, you know, I can't eat filet mignon all the time. Sometimes I just want to go to the gas station, get me zebra cakes and cookies and Doritos. I have no qualms about this opinion. I am also aware of some of the more problematic elements of Twilight, and to be fair, I am about to perform a little bit as a Twilight apologist. That's not to say the criticism against Twilight are not valid, but I do feel that I might have a better insight as someone who's read Twilight back and forth versus a bandwagoner critic who has never even picked up the first novel. Alright, so first things first. Stephanie Meyer's use of the real-life Quileute tribe is bad. I'm not going to deny this. I'm not happy that, as far as I know, the Twilight franchise has done little to support the tribe and contributes to spreading misinformation about the Quileute people. There is actually currently a campaign to help the tribe protect its history and its heritage called Move to Higher Ground. I'm going to go ahead and post a link to that information in the show notes. And I recommend that everyone at least give it a look if they enjoy Twilight in any shape or form. Now, we're going to go ahead and get into the meat of it. A big, big thing about Twilight for a lot of folks is a lot of folks believe that Twilight is an example of an abusive relationship. So we're going to look at Edward. He is strict, overbearing, emotionally manipulative, and who knows what else. And the critics aren't exactly wrong. I kind of hand-wave this aspect as, well, Edward is a vampire. That's the crux of it. If they were real people, I would have no problem saying this is really bad, this is not good, but this is a fantasy book. Stephanie Meyer herself is, in fact, and I said this last week, that, you know, fictional people shouldn't be role models. That's her opinion. So, Edward's a vampire. To him, Bella is an exceptionally alluring human, as in, she smells ridiculously delicious to most vampires. And this effect is magnified tenfold to Edward himself. When he meets the Volturi in the second book, they call it the Singing Blood, I think. I can't remember the Italian for it, or whatever the Italian is said what it is. Edward finds himself falling in love with Bella, despite how wonderful she smells to him, but with the knowledge that she is an extremely defenseless, fragile, and tasty human. There's actually a moment in the first Twilight book where Edward remarks on this. He's taken Bella to his house for the very first time to meet his family. And as he's playing a piano song for her, he's actually explaining to her that there are some nomadic vampires coming to their area very soon. So he might, you know, be really overprotective or overbearing. He lays it out for her. He tells her what to expect and why. I think the quote is, I wouldn't want you to think that I'm naturally a tyrant. This is still questionable behavior, of course, but it makes sense to the world in which we are engaging. Edward does not want anything bad to happen to Bella, and when nomadic vampires are in town and his girlfriend smells really good, he does not want to leave anything to chance. And it would be one thing if Bella was like, oh my god, you're being terrible, oh my god, no. She's like, eh, sure, whatever. And he explains everything to her. I think that's the one thing. He explains everything to her. He's not, like, telling her she can't do something just because he says so. He's telling her why things are happening. And as for Edward's emotional manipulation, he can read minds. Or rather, people's minds are sort of projected at him, and he has to sit through the onslaught of everyone's thoughts. You don't really spend almost a century listening to how the human mind works without learning how to manipulate people. And I'm using manipulation as a neutral term here, not as a bad or good thing, not in that binary. It's just something that everyone does. Like, you know, I was, talking to little kids at Disney, and, you know, they're crazy and whatnot, and you give them a sticker to make them happy. That's a form of manipulation. It's like, here, have a sticker, be happy. It solves a lot of problems, amazingly. But with that thought, probably if Edward had been older when he was turned, with his mind reading and this, you know, emotional knowledge, he'd probably follow a career as a therapist, much as the way Carlyle does as a doctor. Yes, I know all their names. Another example would be probably in Eclipse, the third book, when Bella wants to go see Jacob, her friend. Well, if you remember, Jacob is a werewolf. And the thing about the werewolves in Twilight is that they're more like shapeshifters. They're not guided by the moon or anything like that. But their transformations are really emotionally driven, I guess. They're really unpredictable. One of the characters, Alice, can see the future, but she can't see the wolves on Lepush, or at Lepush, or the Quileute wolves, I guess they call them. Again, not great, Meyer. But, and she can't see the wolves because they are very, very unpredictable. And one character actually had been injured by one of the werewolves. And Edward knows this. And when Bella wants to go see the werewolf, her werewolf friend, he's like, no, you can't do that. It's compounded by the fact that they actually have a treaty with the Quileutes that the Cullens cannot come anywhere near the reservation. It's just, and Edward can't be there to protect her. That's just how it is. again, it doesn't look great, but, you know, when you look at the guy who sees all of the werewolves who basically, like, transform into giant hulking wolves the moment they get angry about something, and Bella tends to, like, you know, speak her mind, it's not a good feeling. And if you can't run over there to protect her, you really don't want to do that. So that's one explanation. Again, I'm not excusing his behavior, I am explaining it. It's just how it is. Now for the age thing with Edward. He is 100-something years old. Like, technically. Functionally, Edward was changed at 17. And in some ways, he is still a 17-year-old teenager. You can really, really see it in Midnight Sun, but we'll get there. What a lot of folks like to bring up is this so-called age gap between Edward and Bella. And again, they aren't wrong, but again, vampire. And I will take this moment to say that Edward is staunchly against any kind of physical relationship between him and Bella. I think what a lot of detractors might be thinking of that, you know, is Edward's like, oh, I'll just wait. It's fine. I can wait. I've waited a century. I can wait, like, you know, 2 more years. That's not what's happening at all. He doesn't want to have a physical relationship, firstly, for her safety, because he is stupid strong. Like, he could, like, crumble stone in his hands. And he's concerned about hurting her. And secondly, because Edward was, quote, raised by Carlyle, who has a slight religious slant in his personality, thanks to his background. And Twilight was written by a Mormon. So there's a very traditional approach to their relationship. Edward and Bella don't knock boots until they are married in the fourth book. Twilight as a franchise is incredibly chaste, but remember, it was written most likely with teenage girls in mind. It's just another way for young women to explore their sexuality without pressure. And as the great Lindsay Ellis once said, we as a society kind of hate teenage girls. Yes, Twilight is stupid, but so is Fast and the Furious, but only one of these gets a pass. Wonder why that is. Anyway, now as for Jacob, he's a nice guy, TM. He is grade A nice guy, and that's not a good thing. He's just... the movies are amazing with this. They just beef up the rivalry between Edward and Jacob, and it's hilarious, and that's one of the reasons I love them so much, because they're so horrible, and I love it. Anyway, I really could go on forever. I haven't even touched the strangeness that is the imprinting thing, which is weird and strange. But again, that also gets addressed in the text. Like, you know, before I run away with myself, let's go ahead and finally move on to Midnight Sun. So this is Twilight from Edward's perspective, and oh boy! If you want to read 650 pages of prime emo crybaby Edward, Midnight Sun is definitely for you. Oh my god. It's almost 25 hours via audiobook. And I really don't like the narrator they picked. he makes Edward sound like a serial killer, not a 17-year-old idiot vampire. It's just... oh my gosh, he's just, like, every bit as grouchy, growling, emo vampire as you would expect. He's like, oh my god, I'm so terrible. It's like, he's, like, all of the memes personified. It's amazing and hilarious. And for the book itself, Edward can read minds, remember, so we get so much more with Midnight Sun. I want to say, like, it's, like, half the length, almost. We get everybody's thoughts around him. I like the change in the perspective from seeing everything from Edward's point of view. Getting insights into different family members was enjoyable. It makes me like Alice all the more. I really love Esme in this version. Esme is very sweet. Alice is hilarious. She's the best character. I'm sorry. Alice is the best. And we are surrounded by everyone's thoughts and how they are affected by Bella. So it's really a very interesting viewpoint. Some parts of the novel exonerate Edward. Other parts have me groaning, mostly the emo-ness. But the cringe fest is exactly why I like Twilight. It's why I like the movie so much, because Edward is hilarious in his self-pity. I'd probably like Midnight Sun even more if every 3 sentences weren't exactly about how Edward hated himself. Like, it's just everything's like, wow, Bella's so amazing, I'm a monster. It's the entire novel. Now, the really interesting book, in my opinion, is Life and Death. This is gender-bent Twilight, and I don't mean just Bella and Edward. I mean everyone is a different gender. Like, even from the inconsequential secretary in the school. Everyone, that is, except Charlie and Renee, Beau's parents. Edward becomes Edith, and so on and so forth. Personally, I feel as though Life and Death is the more compelling story, because of those flipped genders. Edith's behavior is softer somehow. It makes a little bit more sense than Edward's. Beau's awkwardness works better than Bella's ever did. And the gender swap of the family members allows for some fun trope busting. Emmett is the biggest vampire in the Cullen family, and he's basically brute, burly, and loves grizzly bears. His female counterpart, Eleanor, is basically that, just a woman, and it's incredible. Like, I would read a whole book about that. That's great. And I think it was a YouTuber, Amanda the Jedi, who mentioned that a way better idea would be Edith and Bella. I don't think she's wrong. I won't disagree there, because I would read the hell out of that. At the end of Life and Death, though, we get this massive lore info dump that I think would be highly deserving of an actual series. And yes, I would read it. It would just be like Meyer to build up this entire world and just kick it to the side so she can force us to watch her shipping madness. The other thing about it is, oh my god, spoilers if you didn't know, at the end of Twilight, Bella does not become a vampire, but at the end of Life and Death, Beau does. The thing about the Twilight arc is Bella is human, Bella is a woman. One of the vampires, Rosalie, wishes she had what Bella has, which is a future. She has hope. She has a chance to grow and have a family. And she hates Bella a little bit, because she feels like Bella is throwing that away. We get to Breaking Dawn, and it turns out that Bella can get pregnant by Edward. That's a whole mess by itself. We're not even going to talk about that. And the baby, the fetus, is not good for Bella. Like, Bella nearly dies trying to carry this child. I could go forever on the themes of, you know, Bella having this kid and carrying this kid, and oh boy, that's a minefield, and I'm not going to go there, But what happens is that Rosalie sees Bella fighting for this baby's life, and Rosalie's like, that's what I would have done. And Rosalie's like, all right, Bella, I'm Team Bella now, let's go. And the thing for Twilight is that Bella had to have that happen to her for the story to come full circle. Whether or not that was a good plan for the story is debatable. But when we have Life and Death, Beau can't get pregnant. Beau cannot have a child. He can maybe have children, but he cannot carry children. So it's not like he and Edith could have a baby. It's not possible, because vampire women cannot become pregnant. Their bodies are unchangeable, and pregnancy is all about changing the body. So the story of Life and Death would have to end with Beau becoming the vampire, because he's, in theory, he's got nowhere else to go the way Bella did as far as having kids goes. It's a loaded topic. I totally get it. It's just a type of interpretation that I have. So it does make sense thematically that Beau becomes the vampire at the end. I would say that I kind of enjoyed Life and Death, but Twilight itself will always hold a special place in its heart, in all its hilarious, problematic glory. All right, I think I've inflicted enough of this on you all, so I'm going to go ahead and leave you for now. Hopefully I haven't scared you all off permanently, and you'll join me next week as we read Penniless and Pregnant in Paradise by Sharon Kendrick. Thank you for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. Also, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will go a long way to help the show, and I can keep bringing you lots of fun episodes. Thank you to our early reviewers. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwang Yun Cho. Hopelessly Romantic is an H with K production. And it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.